to the last chant on the first page, one time.
Chant I'm very familiar with, but we do it quite differently in Naples, so that should help a little bit. What? Can people come closer?
There's a seat up over here.
Thanks.
Usually they don't move, but you're being persuasive. And they're being flexible.
She's better looking than you are, Al.
That's true. So, good morning. Thank you for coming out on a rainy morning. In Naples, sometimes we do this thing, especially when there are unfamiliar faces, and there are a handful of unfamiliar faces here for me. So it's kind of nice to go around the room and is it okay to take the time to do this? Just say your name, and sometimes we play this kind of lighthearted game of asking a random question. So my question to you this morning is, what is your name, and what is your favorite thing about having electricity? So I'll go first. My name is Lori, and when my power came back on, I was in a cold shower, and I got out of the cold shower and realized there was light coming from a place that I hadn't seen in the past week. So my favorite thing became walking into rooms and just flipping. What a wonderful thing to walk into a room and flip a switch and be able to see where you're going and what you're looking for. So my favorite thing is light.
My name's Mike. My favorite thing about electricity is getting shocked.
Wow, that's a hard one to follow. I'm Robin, air conditioning.
Mm-hmm. I'm Joe, and I did all the air conditioning.
Uh-huh. Great, I love music.
Music.
Ginger, air conditioning. Mm-hmm.
Tim, I'm air conditioning also.
I'm Dale, and I like watching people get shocked.
Yeah, I'm going to say air conditioning also.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we go this way?
My name is Tanai. I guess warm water, and you can heat.
Warm water.
My name is Mary, and I just like being able to have Wi-Fi.
Kelly, air conditioning and a clean pool. I had to add that. Elizabeth, and that all the food that I can cook. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
With electricity.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, air conditioning and hot water.
Okay, a lot of great things that this gives us. Thing that we really don't understand until we don't have it. I have very limited understanding of how my light switch goes on, even still. So my topic for this morning comes from this really beautiful collection of stories, or you could call them koans, called The Hidden Lamp. Is anybody familiar with this book? It came out in 2013, and this particular copy was a gift. I'd heard about this book for probably since 2013, and it was I went to a session, a week-long silent retreat in Western Mass a couple of months ago, and I was in silence, of course, but at the end of the retreat, I was talking to a couple people, and this book came up. And this man that was standing there left the conversation, came back with his copy and handed it to me, this stranger. And this is actually a signed copy signed by a couple of the commentators that commented on the stories. So what this is the subtitle is Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women. So in the history of Zen, in the history of the world, women are largely absent. So we know that there were these powerful women that shaped how we came here, but we hear so little about them until very recently. And this book is, to me, just a treasure of getting to know these women. I've been involved in Zen practice since 2003 was when I moved to Melbourne and met Sensei Al. And in, as you know, in Zen literature, there are a lot of stories about the patriarchs and the male ancestors and all the people that gave us this beautiful tradition, and we hear very little about the women. This particular collection is 100 koans, 100 commentators. And in the foreword, Norman Fisher speaks beautifully about what it is about this particular collection that makes it different than the classical collections like the Mumon Khan, the Blue Cliff Record, the collections that we work with here at Open Mind Zen. And the way he described it is distinguishing between what he called the grasping way and the granting way. So the grasping way is this method that in the classical collections, like the Mumon Khan, and especially the Blue Cliff Record, sometimes the language is very difficult to understand because it comes with so much cultural things that are just lost in translation. And there, for me, is this spirit of something being very hidden and very esoteric, and just really, it takes a lot of effort to crack that nut. Versus what Norman Fisher calls the granting way, which is a grandmotherly, open-handed, open-hearted, very direct language, very pure, this sort of thing. And if you pick up this book, I think you'll really get a sense of that spirit, all completely open. So not that one way is better than the other, of course, just it feels like this book and this style of teaching is filling a void that's long been present. So another kind of unique thing about this collection is the classical collections are usually compiled by one author, Mumon, for example, or two. Maybe there's one person that compiled the koans and maybe one other commentator. This collection is 100 commentators spanning the range of Buddhist traditions, all Buddhist traditions spanning the range of time. So we're not just talking about stories of people from the 7th and 8th century that feel so distant. They're actually stories towards the end of living teachers that have now become koans, that we can work with as koans. So it's really neat to get 2,500 years of women in this much space, right? And I feel like they've done a really great job. So the particular koan I want to speak about is this exchange between, it comes from 9th century China, and it's this exchange between a teacher named Zhou Xu. Many of us have heard of Zhou Xu because he's the subject of several of the classical koans, you know, the one about the dog and the Buddha nature. You might know the one about Nansen, his teacher, cutting the cat in half, and Zhou Xu responding later by putting a sandal on his head and walking out the door. Doesn't matter, but he's the subject of a lot of koans and a really central figure in this era of Buddhism. In this particular koan, he's having an interaction with a nameless nun. And this is very frequently how we hear about women in these stories is we don't know their names, but it doesn't matter because she doesn't need a name. She's so awesome. So this is a very unlikely exchange. In Zen at the time, it was really hard for women to practice. In many cases, they just completely weren't allowed to practice. And if they did, it was only if all other, you know, of their traditional roles were exhausted. For example, if their husband had died, maybe then they were allowed to practice. If their children were born and had left the house, maybe they were allowed to practice separately from the monks. And I even more recently heard of this thing that just blew my mind, that apparently some women went so far as to scar their faces so that they wouldn't, so that they could go to the monastery and not be a distraction to the monks for being too beautiful. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine this? Mm-hmm. Can you imagine a woman saying, I want to practice, I really want to meditate and study and see what all these men are up to, but they're going to find me distracting, because this was a thing. And sometimes it wasn't so much that the, maybe it was the feeling that the women weren't capable of awakening, but it was also this added element of you're gonna make the men distracted. So this meeting between Joshu and this nameless nun, we don't know about the circumstances that brought them together, but it's really significant that they even came together and had this exchange. So I'll read the koan. And the title of the koan is Joshu's Deeply Secret Mind. A nun asked Master Joshu, what is the deeply secret mind? Joshu squeezed her hand. The nun said, do you still have this? Joshu said, you are the one who has this. I'll read this one more time. It's quite a simple little koan, but so rich and so subtle what's happening between these two people. A nun asked Master Joshu, what is the deeply secret mind? Joshu squeezed her hand. The nun said, do you still have this? Joshu said, you are the one who has this. So the way I'm experiencing this is the meeting of really two equals. It's a powerful question. She's asking him, what is this deeply secret mind? Another translation of this that the commentator mentioned was, what is the innermost mind? So it's a heavy question. And in our Zen practice, we all are here because we have this sense when we begin to practice, like there's something I'm not seeing, there's some deep secret. And maybe it's out there, maybe the teacher knows it, maybe the book has it, maybe I have it, but I don't see it. So let me meditate and see what that hidden little nugget or jewel, sometimes it's equated to a jewel, a precious jewel or gem. Let me sit down and have a look and see if I can find this thing. What we discover ultimately is that there's another very related koan about searching for that hidden thing. The harder we look, the further away we get from it. Yet if we didn't sit down and look for it, we would, it's a lost cause, right? So there's this feeling of something hidden that we sit to reveal. And I think it's an interesting thing with this koan. I was actually sitting with the feeling of a jewel somewhere in my body and allowing layers and layers of thoughts, beliefs, ideas about myself to drop away. But I feel that this is really what Zen practice ultimately is allowing every single thing that arises to drop away and see what's left. And the moment you think you see, have that gem, oh, there it is. You point to it. The moment you do this, it's already gone. This is this effort of grasping and nailing it to the wall is, it's in the gem's nature not to be allowed to be grasped. So impossible. Yet, we need to do this. This search is necessary. So I mentioned the other translation, what is this innermost mind? And I think that finding this jewel is maybe a lot less about what the message is or what that deep secret is, and a lot more about the spirit in which we look for it and the what arises as a result of the search. I was thinking about, I was just with my family in Orlando. Oftentimes when I come here, I'll stop on the way. It's a little bit out of the way, but I'll stop on the way and just connect with them. And with my mom and my sister and my brother and all their kids, it's kind of a neat little tribe. And I was thinking of this game that we used to play when I was very small, called, I don't know what it was called, but button, where is the button? Does anybody know this game? So the way this goes, maybe it's a Mormon thing or a Midwestern thing, because I don't know of anybody else that's played this, but all the kids are in a circle much like this, and mom has a button in her hands like this. And everybody, all the kids in the circle hold out their hands like this, and mom goes around with her hands in between Mike's hands, and then, and at some point, she drops that button into somebody's hands, but nobody knows who, except, of course, if you're the one with the button. And this is so much fun, because it's mom with this precious jewel that has no value. But in those circumstances, man, you want that button. It's really valuable. And if you get that button, it's all you can do to poker face, right? The whole point of the game is to not reveal this secret, this special secret. So I think Zen practice is like this. It's not so much about that there's anything intrinsically valuable about that button compared to anything else. It's about the spirit in which we hold whatever that button happens to be in that moment. And I think there can be this playful, lighthearted aspect to our Zen practice. So there's also this element and a secret. I was thinking a lot about what secrets mean to me. So very often we think of a secret being mine, something that I guard because it's a secret. I don't want other people to know, right? I have, amongst my closest friends, I have this reputation of being really good at keeping my own secrets, not so good at keeping other people's secrets. And I think what this is about, I'm working on this, of course, but I think what this is about is the joy in a secret comes from not understanding that it isn't mine to keep. I can share this with somebody very trusted, and then it takes on a whole new life. So there's this feeling of specialness when we then can open ourselves up, and whatever that button is, or that deep dark secret, or that deep beautiful secret, how much more valuable and more beautiful when we share this with another person. One of the things that's really struck me in recent years as far as Zen teachers go, and I noticed this with Sensei Al. Did you guys notice maybe a month or two or 3 months ago he cut his hair shorter? Anybody notice? So I especially noticed this with one of the teachers at this place called Boundless Way, where I went to Sesshin a couple months ago. There's this teacher, particular teacher, an older man, completely shaved head. When you meet a person with a shaved head, it's very different than meeting that same person with hair. And I was wondering, what is it about that? And I think it for me, it's about this feeling of no secret shared. A hairdo has a way of softening a person, right? Kind of giving them a look, I suppose you could say, or a style, or an expression of certainly who they are. But when all of that is gone, there's really this feeling of just completely meeting this, in this case of this teacher I'm thinking of, meeting a very clear mirror who's holding on to nothing, who has no deep dark secrets. And as a result of that, is really able to teach in a pure way, a very direct way. I noticed right away when Sensei shaved his head. It's interesting, and I'm going to say this out loud right now. Sometime in my life, I will do it. I got closer, a little bit closer with this last one, but not ready to go all the way yet. So this transparency and this rawness and nakedness of not just teachers, but all of us to recognize that, yes, there are these beautiful secrets, and they're not really ours. They're not ours to keep. So the way that these two people, Joshu and the nun, are communicating or transmitting this secret, I think is really interesting. So she asks him, what is this deep, dark, or she doesn't say dark, what is the deeply secret mind? And he doesn't answer with words. He answers with a squeeze of the hand. And these gestures, we've all had these experiences of words just not touching what it is that we're trying to communicate. We've all felt this. And the moment we try to put words onto this, we dance around in circles, and it can be quite frustrating. So how powerful to not go there, just to use something else. We have all these other means of expressing something that is so subtle, like a secret. So a squeeze of the hand, a glance of the eyes. Have you ever been at a party with your partner and you're stuck in a conversation that maybe you want to get out of, and all it takes is and this is enough? And we all have opportunities to explore this part of our practice. For me, that sort of communication can be way more intimate than saying, how you doing today, Lynn? I'm sorry you're going through that, or whatever it is. I was sitting, as we all know, Naples was pretty much a direct hit from Irma, and I did fine. I had a great time. I was having a party for a week. But for some people, it brought up a lot of suffering. And I was sitting with this woman after meditation last week. We go to this coffee shop typically after meditation, and I could tell she was just having a hard time. And a lot of times after going through something traumatic like this, I think people feel the need to make sense of it. What was that about? What lesson did I learn? And why? What is this for? And I could see that she was trying to do that, but couldn't quite figure out how to say this to me. And we were at a table with other people, so it wasn't an ideal setting to communicate verbally about this. And I could see she was right there, so I just grabbed her hand, and I thought it was significant that a day later I picked up this koan. I thought it was cool. So I just took her hand and held her hand and looked at her, and she began to tear up a little bit, but she said some things and it moved through, and then she was fine, went back to her coffee, and there we were. So these very simple ways of connecting to each other that are maybe outside of the box, the way we would normally try to reach someone. I would like to read just a little bit of the commentary. And this, maybe someone has heard of this teacher. This was a not familiar name. Another woman that I would love to know, and I think it's significant that now I know her name. She's not a nameless nun on the side of the road. Her name is Ikushin Dana Velden. Anybody know who this is? This is her commentary on this exchange between Joshu and the nun. She says, in the end, I have no answer to this koan, at least not in words. The nun and Joshu continue on. I feel their ease and intimacy, and how together they create an understanding that is deeper than if they were separate. The river that flows through everything is understood to flow through everything, and so it does, back and forth. Boundless waters, endless sky, dragon play. I love that, dragon play. There's a lighthearted quality to dragons, which in Zen lore, dragons are the awakened ones. So these aren't secrets, but perhaps they are mysteries to be discovered over and over again. innermost but not hidden, they flow from warm hand to warm hand. The plain and courageous intimacy of one human life intersecting with another, beyond words, beyond comprehension, and yet fully and completely received. So this is a perfect koan. Beyond words, beyond comprehension even, beyond anything we can conceive of, and yet fully and completely received through this just squeezing of the hand. And then another neat thing about this book, and I'll leave this here if anybody wants to, you know, take a quick peek after, but they're short chapters, which I love, and and really clear koans, not the koans like this, that you're like, well, who's that again, and, you know, all these different characters, very clear, and a commentary by teachers that in many cases I'm learning about. And then at the end of each chapter there's a question that's relevant to the koan, and this is in plain language an encouragement or a window or a pathway into how might I work with this in my daily life. And these are, I think, really powerful things. So the question that ends this chapter is, when you hold a precious secret that can't be spoken, how can you share it? Hmm. Maybe we don't have to speak the secret, but maybe what it reveals in our own mind, in our own practice, can be transmitted somehow to other people without words. My words of explaining what that gem is are very different than your words of explaining what that gem is. So maybe it's better not even to use words. Maybe to just pass the button. Should we play? Anybody have a button about to play?
No one uses buttons anymore.
Velcro.
Velcro.
So how does the, by the way, not to, but how does the game end? So it goes into somebody's hand, then what happens?
I'm very foggy on this, but it doesn't end. Yeah.
It's still going on.
I think the deal is somebody is supposed to, you're supposed to guess who has the button, you know, by subtle gestures. Maybe somebody gives it away. And I think the person who has the button is then the person that stands up and does the giver of the button.
After
the next
guest, after the person who's holding it, his name is guest.
We can go with that. We usually.
He wants to know.
He wants to know how to play.
Possible
litigation.
We shouldn't have had that button.
We tend to make up the rules as we go along. So thank you. If anybody has any comments or thoughts about their secret button, your secret gem, does it have a name? Is it something other than a gem? Is it something you can point to and express in words?
I was wondering if this would be akin to transmission.
Mm-hmm.
When Joshua squeezed the nun's hand, was that a transmission?
It's a great question, and what I didn't think, because what I didn't really get into, is the follow-up questions, right? So he squeezes her hand, and she, let me just make sure I get it right, she says, "Do you still have this?" Like he gave her something, right? And she wants to know, okay, well, thanks, but do you still have it too? What just happened, right? She says, "Do you still have this? What is the this that he gave her?" We don't know, really. And then his response to this is, "You are the one who has this." So maybe he views it as she gave a gift to him. This is why I think this is such a powerful koan. It's really, it's presumably, he's this big famous teacher, so presumably she's a student. and maybe allowed on the periphery. Yet there's this very equal meeting here. Do you still have this? And he says, you are the one that has this. But maybe she needs to hear that from him. I don't know.
So I see a hand squeeze as a gesture of affection.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a completely enlightened being giving her unconditional love, which she has, but maybe she doesn't know she has. I feel like I'm incapable currently of unconditional love. You know, somebody walks up to me and spits in my face 10 times in a row every day, I'm not going to love them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he's completely enlightened. He squeezes her hand. He's transmitting unconditional love, which she doesn't know that she already has. But, and if she gets it or not, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But that would kind of answer the question, no, you have it.
Yeah. I just think we have to be really careful with language that divides awakened from unawakened, because this is, I think, a not an accurate depiction of a description of what really happens in this process. There are no, as far as my experience goes, there are no moments where, okay, now I can say I have unconditional love, period, no matter what. At least I haven't met that moment yet. And when we say, when we're separating that awakened teacher from my experience, this is just furthering our own story about ourselves being not having that thing, right? So the more we feed this with words like this, the more we're stuck, I think.
I was relating it to transmission of the Dharma and transmission of the precepts.
Okay.
In the ceremony.
And you took the precepts?
Yeah.
Okay. So what was this experience for you of receiving, in this case, receiving?
Well, it's a wordless transmission.
Mm-hmm.
It's from one person to another. And it's following a lineage, you know, from the ancients up to the present.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to make an analogy
mm-hmm.
between that and the squeezing of the hand.
It's a beautiful analogy. And through that brush, right, that you get on your right. head, this is connecting you to the time of the Buddha, the time of Joshu, the time of this nun. And then,
exactly.
of course, in the other direction, every practitioner that comes after you forever through all space and time. Pretty heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Yet in a very scientific way, in a very real way, all of that is right here, right now. It could be no other place. So when we practice, when we speak about these things, when we don't speak about these things, everything that happened previous to that is there, is in that moment. Yeah.
I think your talk was just so rich and full in of itself, let alone the koan. when you talked about grabbing the hand, I remembered when you did that for me. And really, yeah, I talk about transmitting. Like it was a transmission for me because it completely, like, grounded me. And it was, and you know, I started crying. It was just like amazing. So I don't know, I just wanted to share that. It's just funny, ironic that talking about that.
Well, see, this is a perfect example of who's transmitting to who. Because mm-hmm. what Kelly is talking about is a breathwork. We did a breathwork session at Kashi. It was a retreat a couple, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. I don't know. But she was having this powerful breathwork experience, and I wanted some of that. So I grabbed her hand, and she experienced this as something very different than the way I experienced this. I just wanted to grab Kelly's hand. So who's transmitting to who? So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, as long as we're sharing, I was here for Scott McBride when he came and spoke. And this is what I was thinking of when you were talking about grabbing the hand. He didn't touch me, but he touched me deeply
mm-hmm.
by bringing this now into the room, into this room. Mm-hmm. And every time I come into the room, I feel it.
Mm-hmm. Since then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it was incredible. It was now. And he worked his whole life to bring that to me.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else probably.
Mm-hmm.
It was powerful. I was thinking about my meditation today. I was using what he taught us. So it's funny to bring it up.
Mm. Well, I keep having the game is just being played in my mind. And one way I imagine it is that the bomb is actually putting a button in everyone's hand. Mm. But each person thinks like it's, oh, I got it, because there's the part of our mind that believes it is separate from everybody else, mm. and, you know, kind of wants to be and doesn't want to be at the same time. And then just having that, that unspeakable thing. There's so many things I want to say. There's almost always, by grace of God, or there are moments in working with people one-on-one that we both just feel like we drop into the same space. So that space could be described as we're inside the button. Mm-hmm. We're inside the hands of creation, and somehow we know it. Then inside that place, it's that nowness, and nothing else needs to be happening, mm-hmm. except this, mm-hmm. right here, absolutely amazing, quiet, endless now. And so just kind of being in that space with each other. And I love that the hand squeeze and the simple communication of words was kind of a letting the experience of non-dual awareness get also translated into our humanness, where we have a mind that uses language to understand and hold on and even transmit our experience. And we have a body to experientially try to take the energy that's bodiless, mm. and yet touch each other with it. Mm-hmm. So I loved your talk in so many ways. And I think I really got a better understanding of Dharma talks. So I was having a conversation with someone in another Zen Sangha, and we're talking about the nature of Dharma talks. And I can always notice that there's a left brain Western mind up here that wants, I want to know the point. I want you to flesh out the point you're making. I want you to return to the point at the end. I want you to, you know, take me somewhere so that I walk away and go like, all right, I learned something and satisfied that left brain. And yet, you know, what I experienced with your talk was as a dance. Mm-hmm. Around this knowingness, this unspeakable knowingness, mm-hmm. and I also experienced your delight, mm-hmm. in being in the dance, mm-hmm. and sharing the dance with all of us. So it was really impactful to me, mm-hmm. in that beautiful way, and really given me, you know, something to aspire to drop into. Mm-hmm. Even when my left brain is going, no, but you can go this way. So then the last thing I wanted to say is another book in this same kind of a theme is called Women in Praise of the Sacred. Do you know that book?
I don't.
But it's also about 2,500 years of the words of women mystics and poets, from all traditions and all cultures and all over the worlds, and that book I have since. Women in Praise of the Sacred, and it's curated, or the editor is Jane Hirschfield.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She could be in there because she's a Zen, mm-hmm. teacher, yeah. too. Mm-hmm.
Well said.
Thank you.
Just one thing that this was bringing up for me was in my practice, I it's interesting, communicating beyond is something that's transcendent, but through this human form that is female or male in most cases, right? So finding the most skillful means for this form to communicate something way beyond this form. And I'm so fortunate to have multiple entry points. I often take so much joy in working with kids. I'm a musician, and I love performing, of course, but I teach young musicians, middle schoolers, and it's not at all about that paradiddle or that flam or that scale or that stupid thing they're gonna forget next week. It's about using that medium as a way to touch something in this kid that really wants to be awakened. Some ability to put into through his body something that he can't put through in any other way. And when I see this happen with young kids, and they couldn't even begin to express what's happening in words, all they know is this is fun and I want to do it again and I like her and whatever it is. So I think we all, whether it's through Zen practice or our work or our family life, we all have these really powerful mediums. It's interesting for me. I feel like I need the thing in between. I need, here's me and here's that person I want to connect to. I need music. I need Zen. I need some topic, some intermediary medium to move through. Maybe we're all like that. I don't know.
I just want to say, you know, Robin talked about Scott McBride, and I think all of the wonderful teachers that we have, there's just a transfer of energy, and that energy is like it's the universal energy that just flows through, and it's so obvious when someone really has cleared themselves in a way that can happen, and it's palpable. I mean, you know it right away. Mm-hmm. You're one of them, Elizabeth, Mike. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the people that teach here are like that. Kelly, and Sensei, of course, obviously, the head of the line, but a number of things came up for me, but I just wanted to say that about what a beautiful teacher you are, always. Mm-hmm. And I'm so grateful for that, and that you make the trip over here from time to time to share it with us. But when we were talking about the secret mind and the hand touch, I remembered a time when I was at work having my lunch with another coworker, and I wasn't feeling good. And we'd been working together for a long, long time, and she has kids and grandkids, and, you know, so she's used to families and everything. And she just got up and she started to rub my back. She just, you know, did that. And she didn't say anything, and it was just such an amazing experience, because it was the transmission of that, you know, connection with all that we are at the very ground of things, you know, and who we are on a human level. And nothing needed to be said. And I have to say, I mean, I felt so much better afterwards. You know, just sometimes the simplest thing is the most appropriate thing. And I, you know, language can be a really, really amazing tool. And if we're really attuned, you know, some people are really expert at using it well. But often, I think it can be a barrier. And the simple touch, the simple look, the whatever, can be so much more powerful. I used to work at a library, and I checked out a video one time called The Great Silence, which is well worth watching sometime. It's about a Christian monastery and these men who've dedicated their lives to, you know, the sacred. And it's silent. And, you know, it's actually a fairly long documentary. At the beginning, it was like so uncomfortable that there was no sound. You know, we're just watching these men go through their daily lives. And but by the end of it, I thought to myself, oh my God, if we'd all
just shut up for a while. I mean, there was just such a, you know, and I think that's what's powerful about coming in and doing our practice here or at home or wherever, is we stop. We be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
We let things settle. And that was an amazing, I mean, it was just an amazing thing that these men go through their lives day by day in silence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible to communicate,
mm-hmm,
even in that state.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you.
I think Scott could have, McBride could have, I have no idea what he said. I couldn't tell you to this day. But he could have mumbled syllables that made no sense. And it would have done just as much.
Mm-hmm.
It was just...
I'll remember that. In my next talk.
That would be refreshing.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I'm done. I was going to say something else, but I'm done.
That's wise.
The story that you mentioned there, what it brought up for me was an experience that I had. I've told it before, but probably not everyone's heard it. Where in 1983, I moved from LA to Boston, and I spent a year not practicing at a group because I was really burned out on the groups I practiced with in LA. They were very, it was a very authoritarian, patriarchal Japanese, you could say, abusive at times system that I practiced in. And so when I first moved to Boston, the first thing I wanted to do is none of that. So I was just, you know, I was sitting on my own a little bit. And then I started kind of feeling, well, I want to find a group. I kind of felt about a year later. And I'd heard about Maureen Freegood Roshi, who had a place in Cambridge, Mass., which wasn't far from where I was living, but I couldn't find it. It was secret. There was no advertising. They didn't publicize where it was. There was a reason for that, because on the street they lived, it was all these big mansions, you know, and it was not technically a commercial zone, so they didn't want a bunch of cars there all the time, so they didn't publicize it. But somehow people found out about it, and the way I found out about it was through a mutual friend, Rick Fields, who had, you know, he was pretty hooked into the whole Buddhist world. So anyway, first time I'd ever practiced with a woman teacher, and I went and I did a retreat there. And, you know, in Zen, they have these sticks called the kyosaku, and you walk around, the monitor walks around and whacks people with the stick to wake them up. And it's a little scary, especially if it's done the Japanese way, which is whenever they feel like whoever they want to hit. You know, these days, usually you have to ask for it before they strike you with it. But anyway, she went around, and as we're sitting there, all of a sudden I felt someone's hands on my shoulder just massaging. And she would go around, instead of whacking everyone with a stick, she'd come around and just massage everyone's shoulders. And it was like, it hit me like a thunderbolt. It was like, I remember that touch to this day. It totally changed my notion of what Zen could be.
Mm.
Wow, Zen doesn't have to be yelling and whacking with sticks. It could be a motherly or grandmotherly figure massaging your shoulders. It had the same effect. It relaxed your shoulders, you know? And it changed everything. Just that one action of touch, right?
This is what Norman Fisher was talking about,
right.
The grasping way and the granting way.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she actually got a lot of flack for that at the time, for that kind of thing, because almost all the teachers were men and very kind of traditional Japanese.
Mm.
Now, of course, it's a lot more common.
Mm-hmm.
A lot more women involved.
Did you have something?
Yeah, like that holding the hand can be interpreted as like a transmission. I think it could also be interpreted as like an unburdening.
Mm.
In the sense that, like, we can be prisoner of our own secrets.
Mm.
And by, like, unburdening yourself of the secret, then you sort of set yourself free.
Thank you. This is a completely different... I'm pausing here because Mike has this way of... he's there, and... He did this to me recently in another circumstance.
Yeah.
And it makes me pause and tear up because I had a moment recently that I had not at all associated with this story. An experience recently of unburdening myself of a really heavy secret with somebody very close to me. And I hadn't at all looked at that. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. I think there's also like an ambiguity about it. So if you think of like the holding the hand as being like a work of art, it's not clear what, like in music.
Mm-hmm.
So like you play music and I hear it and I get something from it. And it's like a transmission that's different than language. But it's not altogether clear that what I got from it is what you intended,
mm-hmm.
or that it matters.
It does, it right. I don't think it does.
Yeah, you know, just, I feel moved by it.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel moved by playing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's good enough.
Right.
Yeah, it reminds me of Bob Dylan's early lyrics, which everyone at the time was trying to interpret. And whenever they try to get him to interpret them, he would just totally blow them off. It's like he would refuse to interpret the lyrics. And I thought that was always great that he refused to interpret them, that it, you know, was, he believed you should get out of it what you got, not his interpretation.
Mm.
So that was good.
And that's like another example of that mind that wants to, when you put an interpretation on something, now I own it, you know, I've taken a picture and put it in a frame,
right.
That's what it is. And yet, in music, the player and the listener are in the moment, and they're, aren't they just, you're feeding off the whatever energy field of your listeners,
mm-hmm.
so the music is being called through you by them,
mm-hmm.
and they're, I mean, it's just like there's this co-creative aspect of being in the moment, co-emergent, and that, you know, to just kind of, again, the mind wants to capture it, and now I got it, and then it just, and then if you keep revisiting it in the now moment, now it's different.
Mm.
Now it's now. Now it's who we are in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Not what you played last week. But anyway.
We're doing this right now, and this won't, I'm gonna push stop.